Hello, I'm Dr. Howarth. I'm Global Clinical Scientific Lead at GSK, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to this non-promotional, non-CME disease state educational podcast brought to you by EAACI in collaboration with and paid for by GlaxoSmithKline. I'm delighted to have with me today Dr. Florence Rufos, from the Hospital Erasme in Brussels, Belgium, and Dr. Maria Cid from the Hospital Clinic, University of Barcelona in Spain, to help discuss with me the topic of complications and comorbidities associated with hypereosinophilic syndrome. We recognize this is a rare condition, and it may be a condition that you've not had a great deal of experience with. And I think the insight that we'll gain from Dr. Rufos and Dr. Cid's experience is going to be very valuable. So, Dr. Rufos, what are the most prevalent complications of hypereosinophilic syndrome are there that you see in your clinical practice?
So my clinical practice is more or less aligned with what has been published in the field of hypereosinophilic syndrome. The majority of my patients present skin, lung, and digestive symptoms, either separately or any combination of these different organ-based manifestations. For example, people will present with skin lesions. It can be eczema-like lesions. It's frequently quite itchy. Papules that are the presenting symptom of hypereosinophilic syndrome in my particular cohort. Patients may also present with angioedema, with urticaria. Those are the most commonly observed dermatological manifestations. As far as lung manifestations, some patients present with asthmatic complaints and they have obstructive pulmonary function tests, whereas others have more diffusion abnormalities that are due to interstitial pulmonary infiltrates, which abound with eosinophils. These patients are generally breathless, they cough, and those will be the most common presenting symptoms for patients with lung disease. The GI tract, it's very variable. Generally, patients present with any combination of abdominal pain, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. They sometimes have significant bloating. In general, they lose weight because of the combined vomiting and diarrhea plus abdominal pain. So weight loss is a quite common manifestation when there's gastrointestinal involvement. In addition to those three systems, obviously, patients may also have a series of other organ-based complications, most notably the heart, the vascular system are commonly involved. There's an increased coagulability as well that can be responsible for thrombus formation, either in arteries or veins. And there are also neurological complications that can arise either in the central nervous system or the peripheral nervous system. Patients may also have constitutional symptoms, such as low-grade fever, generally not very prominent, but it can be low-grade fever, and general fatigue, malaise, and a lack of well-being.
Thank you. So it may present with quite a diverse range of presentations, so it may go to different specialties before the diagnosis is made. So Dr. Cid, I'm quite interested in the constitutional aspects of hypereosinophilic syndrome, people feeling fatigued or tired. Is that your general experience with these patients?
It's a little bit variable. Some patients present those and some patients do not present these symptoms so intensively. Some patients have also myalgia, and I've seen one case with eosinophilic myopathy that was very prominent with a general weakness in the muscle strength and even dysphagia. So this is one thing that is not very common, but must be kept in mind, the possibility of eosinophilic myopathy as well, because sometimes myalgia are considered like constitutional symptoms because are considered reactive, but sometimes maybe due to true eosinophilic myositis.
No, thank you. I'm just interested in your experience as to sort of the time course. Do these things present very acutely, or is it a sort of more indolent, gradual thing that builds up as far as patients are concerned? the general features or different manifestations of hypereosinophilic syndrome?
Probably Dr. Ruffo's experience is much larger than mine, but in our experience, usually patients present insidiously. Certainly sometimes they can present acute complications. One of our patients had small strokes. And in this case, where is thrombosis in small vessels, sometimes, since these are considered vascular, the differential diagnosis with EGPA is difficult. Sometimes if we see small infarcts in the brain, for instance, and other manifestations secondary to a small blood vessel occlusion because of coagulopathy.
So Dr. Ruffo, is your experience that these patients present acutely with some manifestation of their hypereosinophilic syndrome?
Some do. Like Professor Sid said, it's certainly not that common. I would say it's probably at maximum 10% of patients, probably less, that present with a very, very acute disease presentation. Most commonly, patients have a kind of a progressive disease course. It can be over a few weeks or months. It can be pretty tight in time, but it worsens progressively, and then they seek medical attention. In the very acute presentations, obviously there's the heart involvement that can present acutely, not because it develops acutely, but because all of a sudden there's a complication of this heart involvement, which is clinically very loud. For example, patients sometimes have valvular entrapment and even rupture of the chordae tendinae, and then all of a sudden they develop acute heart failure because of this. So this is one example of very acute presentations. In my experience, another form of acute presentation is sometimes certain forms of chronic eosinophilic pneumonia. Even though the name chronic eosinophilic pneumonia suggests that this is a chronic disease, the disease flares can be very, very acute. They can develop over just a couple days' time, and suddenly patients are extremely breathless and have a very acute presentation of a recurring disease. And it's because of this recurrence that it's called chronic eosinophilic pneumonia. But during the flares, it can present pretty acutely.
So can I ask, in those that present in this acute fashion, when you reflect on them afterwards, would there have been an opportunity to have made the diagnosis earlier? Had they had symptoms for some time that they perhaps had not paid attention to? Or is it something that comes completely out of the blue?
No, I think that in the majority of cases, yes, there can be some symptoms can be tracked if you really think about how the disease manifestation started. But often, if patients are busy, they have their families, their social lives, their work, they will ignore a series of symptoms that are not necessarily very incapacitating. And then all of a sudden, yes, they present with a more acute and more severe complication. I think there certainly are exceptions where all of a sudden, out of the blue, patients do present with a very, very acute clinical presentation, but it's pretty unusual. The most often what you can see is patients who, oh yes, they did have an itch. Oh yes, they did have some degree of abdominal discomfort, or they did cough or whatever, and then they develop this very acute presentation.
So perhaps I can take the sort of opposite extreme now and ask your opinion. What proportion of patients might it be that they just have a blood test for another reason and it's an incidental finding that their blood eosinophil count is extremely high?
What you're saying is patients who do not have associated symptoms. So this
would
be
it's an incidental finding that they have eosinophilia. Yeah, sure. Yes.
So it's a hypereosinophilia of undetermined significance that you're actually discussing here.
Yes,
and
yes.
I think, once again, it really depends on the center. Depending on whether this is a primary, secondary, tertiary care, it's going to be different, obviously. But I think it must be something like, maybe 2 to 5% of patients. In the majority of cases, you will find an underlying cause and you will see that somehow these eosinophils are actually associated with what are other complications, sometimes very, very mild. But from time to time, indeed, you look for complications very extensively, very thoroughly, and you don't find any. In my personal practice, it is pretty uncommon, which might just reflect the fact that if patients are not symptomatic, they're not referred to me. So I can only speak for my experience in a tertiary center. Probably the proportion is higher in the general public.
Yes, no, you're quite right that obviously these are hypereosinophilia of undetermined origin. They haven't reached the diagnosis of hypereosinophilic syndrome at that stage. But I was just interested to think about how patients might present. Dr. Sid, we talked about different manifestations of hypereosinophilic syndrome, and how you mentioned myalgia, and we thought about how they may present with other complications. But I suppose we also have to think about complications of therapy, and one of the mainstays of treatment is oral corticosteroids, which suppress the hypereosinophilia. I'm just interested to understand your experience about how common those sort of issues are in patients with chronic disease who are managed on oral corticosteroids.
I think we have to consider two different eras in terms of glucocorticosteroid-related complications. The era before the identification of the specific deletions or mutations underlying the myeloid variant that is currently treated with imatinib or related drugs, the availability of mepolizumab for other variants of the hypereosinophilic syndrome. Because in the past, these patients were highly corticodependent. High-dose glucocorticosteroids actually decrease tissue infiltration by eosinophils and reduce blood eosinophilia and controls disease symptoms. But corticodependence was very high in these patients. And actually, complications of long-term glucocorticosteroid administration are well known, including diabetes or exacerbation of previous diabetes, hypertension, heart failure related to hypertension and atrial fibrillation, and then osteoporosis, of course, and infection and GI bleeding. So all these complications can be related to glucocorticosteroid load, and even at lower doses in the long term increased cardiovascular risk. So complications of glucocorticosteroid therapy that these patients need are important. And other treatments that were and are currently still applied to these patients, including, for instance, interferon alpha that have side effects triggering autoimmunity or inducing deep depression, or hydroxyurea that may increase the risk of certain malignancies, as well as a thioprim that increase non-melanoma skin cancer, and other potential side effects.
Thank you very much. It's sobering to reflect, on the adverse consequences of a lot of the treatments that are given that are needed to control the underlying hypereosinophilia, but it adds to the burden of the patients with this condition. Dr. Rufos, are there any concluding comments you'd like to make in relationship to that?
So in relationship to treatment-related comorbidities and complications, yes. I think that it is as much as a concern, I would say, as the comorbidities and complications related to disease itself. And it's actually one of the main reasons why when we treat these patients, we are quite frequently confronted with the decision to suboptimally treat patients to have the best benefit risk ratio in terms of treatment related morbidity. And that obviously exposes patients to the risk of having complications of hypereosinophilia eventually develop over time. We try to keep that eosinophil count as low as possible, but sometimes it is still above the upper threshold of normal, just in order to limit side effects. Treatment is systematically tapered really to the lowest possible dose to be able to control symptoms in eosinophilia, but it's not necessarily a dose that is sufficient to have complete control of these blood and clinical abnormalities. And that is in itself a subject of concern in terms of long-term follow-up of disease.
You very nicely highlight the clinical dilemma that one has in managing these patients, in trying to get the right balance to control the disease, but also limit any potential comorbidities associated not only with the condition, but associated with the treatment. So thank you, Dr. Sid, and thank you, Dr. Rufos, for your insight and giving us the benefit of your clinical experience about the management of patients with hypereosinophilic syndrome and their manifestations. Thank you.
Thank you.